This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Vayner Nation, how are you? Very excited today for a new podcast. It is late summer in New York City, and for us East Coaster, that means it's US Open time, and we have a tremendous guest today talking about a subject matter that I have a lot of passion for. I grew up loving hacking with tennis and watching it. I still think Michael Chang's Paris run is something I think about every time the summer starts, because I'll never forget it. And have been a longtime fan of tennis. And as my career has evolved, I've really become friendly with a lot of the guys and gals on the tour and enjoy it. And my guest today is one of the most significant individuals in the sport today. Some people call him the commissioner of tennis. And I'm excited to yap with him. And really, as we go on this journey of leaning into your passions and doing what you love and really mindset, you want to talk about a sport that really leans into mindset, and even the ebbs and flows in a single match are fascinating. The highs of highs, the lows of lows. As many of you know, Novak Joker is my favorite tennis player. And I legitimately, every time he's down two sets to love in a match, I go to social media and say, and now it's gonna start. And he legitimately lands it for me 8 out of 10 times. And so, Patrick, it's really a great pleasure to have you on the show. Why don't you tell everybody who you are and a little bit about yourself, and then I'll get into some questions.
Thank you, Gary. I didn't know you were such a tennis fan. Happy to know. I'm a tennis fan. I really am a tennis fan. I fell in love with tennis when I was 4 years old as a kid. I used to be a player when I was young, and then I had to stop tennis because my parents thought it was not
a real thing.
Yeah, a too risky thing. Yes. Too risky. They didn't want me to take that risk. And then my life, 10 years later, my life became tennis. I started my own tennis academy when I was 26 in France. My academy became the biggest tennis academy in Europe. And I started coaching. And I coached a few top players. And the last one that I'm still working with for now, almost 10 years, is Serena Williams. So I'm a tennis coach. And then I started to do some businesses in tennis. My tennis academy is one. And then I started to do a few others. So I would define myself as first a coach, a tennis coach, a coach in general, because I think coaching is helping people achieve their potential. And I think whether it's tennis or anything else, it's we're kind of doing the same job. And I'm also a businessman.
Let's go to the beginning. Why at four? You saw it on the telly?
No, my parents, it was the 70s. In the 70s, tennis was big.
Huge.
We had the Borg, McEnroe.
Chris Evert.
Connors, Chris Evert, Navratilova. It was, tennis was huge. So my parents, like many other people, started to play tennis. They were not young. But they started to play, and they were going to the club every weekend. The club became our
weekend.
Second home. Weekend, second home, totally. And I was with other kids, and we were
hacking.
Playing. We started to play.
Yeah, that's right.
And I fell in love immediately.
And were you good at it right away?
Yeah, I was good. Yeah. Actually, as a kid, I was suffering a lot from a lot of problems, including very severe shyness. A lot of anxiety, crisis at night, and the tennis court was the only place where I felt good. I felt confident. I felt I was worth something also because I was bad at school. I was struggling everywhere. And the tennis saved my life also because that was the only place where I was somebody and I was worth something.
In the way that I want to start to evolve my podcast a little bit, I want to jump in here. Listening to Patrick right now, literally what was going through my brain was, shit, that's what business was for me. I wasn't shy, but I was incredibly emotionally charged. I was so empathetic and so competitive that I basically cried twice a day every day. My mom used to tell me, if you don't stop crying, I'm gonna give you something to cry about. That's how much I was crying between 5 and 13, either because I lost in something because I was so crazy, or because somebody picked on somebody in school and that would make me cry because I was so emotionally charged. And business, selling lemonade, washing cars, selling baseball cards was my place of worth, because I also, my report card's right here, I was an atrocious student. And so it's really funny, I very much understand, because that also then became my life and that became my outlet. And I guess why I'm interrupting and jumping in is, if you're listening right now, one important thing to tell a lot of parents is being okay with kids finding other outlets that aren't your ideology. Their outlet may be chess, it might be YouTube. I think about all the parents that stopped their kids from playing video games when today that kid would be making millions playing video games. Parents are good at looking at the past, very bad at looking at the future. When you find passion, you have to groom that passion as a coach, which is what a parent does. And so it's an interesting tie-in. Okay, so you get really good as a kid? Like, do you think at 7, 8, 12, 13, I'm gonna be professional? Does it get that serious for you?
Yeah, it's not even a question for me. It's for sure. It's
so
my
at
life.
9 years old, I am gonna be a professional tennis player.
100%.
Okay, keep going.
Maybe I don't say it, but in my mind, there is nothing else than tennis. Like, literally Saturday and Sunday, I spend 8 hours each day on the court. And I know, I mean, after 1 or 2 hours, the guy on the other side is tired, and then another guy comes, but I don't leave the court. I stay on the court, and I play with maybe 4 different guys. So I don't know if I literally said it to myself, I will be a professional, but my life is only about tennis because my mind is only about tennis.
Right, Monday through Friday is about tennis. Saturday and Sunday, you're physically playing. Monday through Friday, you're in your head.
Totally.
Same with me. That's why I was bad at school. I couldn't think about school. I was thinking about what I was going to sell this weekend. I mean it. I understand it. I listened carefully. So at 16, there was a crossroads where your parents were like, no more. But at 15, 16, you know, humbly, self-aware, could have you gone on a tour in a serious way?
Yeah, I think so too. I really think so. And that's why it was tough. First of all, because it was my life. And you know, I just want to say a few words.
Please.
About what you said, because what you said was extremely true. I would add something. I think parents also envision something for their children, which is their vision, their what they would love to do, what they think is great. And I think that's the major mistakes that they do. They should think, what is my son or my daughter feel is great for him or her? What does he love? What is he good at? It's not a question about what you want, because being parents is not what you want. It's helping your children achieve what they're good at and what they're passionate about.
It's probably what you see done poorly by other coaches in your sport, I'm sure, without even knowing, but you can already tell I know, because I know how life works. There are coaches that are fairly accomplished, but they have a system, and that player must come into their system, which is why they can't be consistently great as a coach. A consistently great coach is in the business of reverse engineering, listening and evolving, and filling out the opportunities predicated on the person.
100% right, thank you. I'm saying that every single day of my life. So, no, but I
said, it changes, right? I'm sure Serena, using her as the icon she is, I have a very funny feeling that 10 years ago, what she needed for her game from your perspective based on what she was different than it was 6 years later.
100%. And what I explain every day is that this is the thing that I created in my tennis academy. I didn't want to create a system that the players should fit in. My goal is to create a system that is different for each player. So I start every collaboration with every player with a white page, and I learn the player. And once I know the player, because I learn the player, then I create a system that is the best system for him.
And that system for her, him, is always evolving.
100%. What is true today might not be true tomorrow.
In my mind, I am a living and breathing counterpuncher to the reality of the day.
That's a great way to say it. I'm going to keep this one.
You got it. All right, so now are you heartbroken? Are you mad at your parents? Or given that era, which that was common, it was pain, you evolve. And so what did you do those next 10 years? I assume you went to university, and then what job did you take?
So first, I was extremely mad at my parents. Okay. Like, you have no idea. Like, literally, they destroyed my life. That's how
right.
I felt
yeah.
it. And it's not that they said you stop, but they didn't support me. So I had no
yeah,
option.
Right.
So in a way, it was the same.
Unfortunately, your entrepreneurship part didn't kick in yet. You couldn't pay for it.
Totally.
Yes.
Totally. And so, and the interesting thing is, I really hated my parents for many years because of what happened. And 10 years after, and that's when I started my tennis academy, I realized that everything that happened was my responsibility and my fault.
I love you for that.
Really, 100%.
I love you for that.
And that changed my life when I realized that.
I actually believe that accountability is the secret potion for happiness. I really believe that. I think people hate accountability. They love to point fingers instead of thumbs. They like to blame bathroom breaks instead of themselves. Keep going. So when you decided to lean into accountability, because I'm sure, just even getting us knowing about you from afar and now getting a quick sense of you, you're in your head from 16 to 26 about tennis.
Yeah.
And so you finally got to that place of adding the ingredient of accountability to the passion, which turned the whole fucking thing.
100%. What I did, you know, I started working, and actually I worked in my father's company because I didn't know anything about business. And he said, come learn a job at least.
What kind of company was it?
It was a renewable energy. It was one of the first ones to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, his company became really big. He was at the stock market also in the US. He had a company in the US, one in France. He's a great businessman.
Yeah.
And he said, I mean.
And do you have siblings? I'm sorry to interrupt.
I have one brother who's younger and he's a professional guitarist. So kind of same story as me. We had something on the side that we were really good at. So my father said, listen, you don't know what to do, because I said, I have no idea what to do. My life is tennis.
Tennis, right. Well, he said, come to the business. Makes sense.
Come and learn a job. I said, okay, I'm going to learn a job. So I started to work with, not with him actually, but in the company for 10 years. And literally at every lunch break,
tennis.
I was going to the tennis. I was eating in front of the courts and I was watching either people playing, like random people, or looking at the courts and imagining everything that could be achieved on that court.
Love.
I was really doing
like,
that.
Like Queen's Gambit, right?
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
You were visualizing.
Exactly. Exactly. And then, so I learned the job. And then 10 years after, my father told me, you're ready. We can start to be business partners. And I knew my life was easy then, if I would say yes. And I told him that I thanked him a lot. And I said, no, I mean, thank you, but I'm lucky. I have a passion. Like most of the people don't have passion. I have one. And I feel like my passion, I didn't fulfill my passion. So I want to come back to tennis, but the thing I suffered the most from, if I think about it, and I thought about it at that time, was that my parents didn't believe in me tennis wise. They didn't think I would be great. Mm. So they said, do something else. And I realized how powerful it is to believe in people and how powerful it is for people to have people who believe in them. 100%. So I said to my father, I'm going to go back to tennis because I want to finish my story. It's not going to be the same story, but I think I have a story with this sport. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to help young players achieve their dreams. This is the thing that I was not given the chance to do. So I will give people the chance to do what I couldn't.
And what's interesting as I'm thinking this through is then you go into that career and you're met with parents that are actually the reverse of your parents. Parents that are delusional a lot of times on how big the ups, right? If they're coming to that academy, these are parents now that actually all believe that their child, which is amazing, but an interest, right? You know, every parent, I assume, going to a real academy, if it became the biggest in Europe, is literally in belief that their child's gonna be number one in the world.
They do believe that their child is gonna be number one, and I think it's great.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, it's great. Of course, you know,
because everything, Shohar Shokhar of Mere is a great, I was born in the Soviet Union. There's a great Russian saying that I just said, which stands for, everything's at its best when it's balanced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot about ambition mixed with practicality. When does a parent thinking a kid's number one, going to an academy, you know, again, I'm projecting here, so jump in. They go into the best academy in Europe. They all think at some point they're way up there. And now I'm just gonna take a cliche kid. A kid comes in, they think they're gonna be number one in the world, and very quickly they meet six other kids that they're not even remotely at the same level. They're going through that calibration of, oh shit, here's four 15-year-olds that are way better than me, 9-year-olds, whatever it is. But their parents are still pushing at a gen. When is that belief that their kid's number one become not a good thing?
That's an extremely good question. I really love people who support their kids 100%.
Of course, given that background.
I think it's the greatest thing that they can do. to be the best supporters of the kids.
But a lot of those parents live vicariously through their kid, right?
That's true. That's true. But still, it's better than not believing in your kids.
Respect.
Much better.
Respect.
I'm 10 times better. That's the best present you can give to people, to believe in them.
What happens when the kid loses passion and the parent doesn't? That's where it gets murky, right?
No, you're right, but mm-hmm. I'm going to still...
Please.
I still want to answer the first question. You can be reasonable when you want to be a champion. It's not about a reason. Richard Williams, from day one, said they will both be number one in the world. The father of Coco Gauff, from day one, I know Coco since she's 10. When she was 10, he was believing she's going to be the greatest of all times. And he believes 1,000,000%. And this has so much power and brings so much belief in their son or their daughter. The value of that, you have no idea.
You know,
I understand
You know what's funny? I'm sorry to interrupt. I fully know. I'm the byproduct of a mother that told me I was going to be the greatest in the world, and I believe it.
And that's why it works.
And when you shoot, you know, one of the things, I know where you're going, because I get so upset with parenting that tries to limit their child, because you have to go for the moon, because if they end up on the top of a tree, that's better than on the ground. If they end up on the top of a mountain, that's better on the ground. But if you don't extend it to the moon, the fuck are we doing?
And you will never achieve something bigger than what you see. If you see your child being at that level, it will never be better than that level.
100%.
So, I mean, unless
that child's lucky enough to have an emotional stronghold within themselves and start to value other people's opinions besides their parent, which is why music has always been powerful, right?
Yeah.
It's why fame is interesting. Fame used properly can be one of the great superpowers in the world, because it gives somebody that a child admires the leverage of that child to dream bigger than the parents are dreaming for them.
Totally, but we always come back to people believing in other people.
100%, my man.
It's always the same thing.
So now you start the academy. Is it an instant hit because you have this 10 years of learning? You probably have some of your dad's natural business DNA. You have the passion, or was it a struggle up front? How did it go from the beginning?
Oh, the start was tough.
Yeah.
I was just renting 2 courts in a club,
right,
at a time when it was not expensive. And
very, right, so bad time slots to keep
great.
The cost down.
Yeah, it's the greatest time.
Yeah. Arbitrage, I love it. Keep going.
When you look back, it's the best moment, because you have to figure out how to make it, starting from scratch. And after 2 years, I realized that I had no chance, because I was nobody in tennis, no credibility, never coached anyone. So I didn't have a lot of things for myself except an incredible motivation, I have no idea, and an incredible ambition, because I went at that time to all the agents who I didn't know, and I said, listen, I'm going to be the best, I'm going to build the biggest academy in Europe, you have to help me now. And they all told me, do it and we'll help you.
Of course.
I said, no, but when I'll do it, I don't need you.
Did you not find one I think the greatest part of my career is being that one person, because I think if you're right 1 out of 10 times, for everybody who's in a luxurious position in their business life or emotionally as a human, being right 1 out of 10 times to the Patricks that come to you will offset the other 9 losses.
I like it.
You didn't find one person.
No. And actually,
it's very European.
Probably.
I have a very anti-entrepreneurship, you know, point of, like, I'm from Europe. I'm born in Eastern Europe, but it baffles me, the lack of, like, the culture, and Europe is so fragmented. This is such a broad statement, and there's tons of amazing entrepreneurs, but, like, fuck, man, I wish there was more entrepreneurship across Europe.
No,
it
I
would
agree.
Help Europe a lot.
I agree.
Keep going.
You're totally right. Yeah. So I thought, I need a name, because I need credibility if I want
an
to convince. No, I need it for my academy, like,
oh,
a coach.
Interesting.
Because if I have a coach's name that is really famous,
of course,
the kids will want
to
come.
So what happened?
I happened to meet the greatest coach in tennis at that time. His name was Bob Rett. He was Australian. As he was, unfortunately, died last year. And I found a way to have a 1 hour meeting with him, and I convinced him. And I want to say just one word about that. When at 16, my parents decided not to follow me in my dreams, and I said I took accountability for that, I understood that I should have convinced them. And this is what I failed. Nobody else did.
That's right.
And I did fail because I haven't been able at that time to listen to them. And if I had understood what they were scared of, for example, I would have convinced them.
Correct.
So from that time, I decided from now, I'm going to convince people.
Right, because the same way you coach people and watch them, it's just reverse engineering if you listen.
Yeah, totally.
100%. So you use that skill set, you understood it at this point. Obviously, look, you were 16. It's hard, you know, to be fully baked at 16. Now at 28 or 29, you've got it, and you're able to convince the best coach in the world to use your academy.
To
train there.
To kind of mentor his name.
Give me his name.
Mm-hmm. And he mentored me, but it was not in the deal, but we had a great relationship, so he helped me. And it became Bob Brett Academy for the first 6 years. So we did 6 years together. And one day he left. He said, I'm going to do my own tennis academy. Well, fair enough. But then I thought, wow, that was the worst investment in my life.
No.
I invested 6 years on a brand, on a name, and this brand becomes now is my competitor.
That's right.
So it's terrible. And that's why I put my name. So I decided, okay, what
I'll
am I going to do?
Never make that mistake again.
I mean,
I get it.
That's important in life. If you keep doing the same mistakes,
fool me once,
you're done.
100%. So, and what happens? Because in those 6 years, I'm sure at the moment it was the worst feeling, but in hindsight now, this is what's good about a couple more gray hairs, right? You realize so much good happened in those 6 years that gave you the leverage for what you're about to say happened next.
Yes, you're right. And I wanted to give up. Honestly, I was so disappointed. Like,
You felt let down.
Yes, on a personal level.
Yeah, makes sense. By the way, this is an important point, everybody that's listening. If you, you know, the gentleman that left, and God rest his soul, you know, when you're that person with the name, sometimes you go through the same feelings. You know, you're renting your name and you had the leverage and, you know, in partnerships, especially the one you described, very tricky. People are coming from very opposite tension points. And, you know, there was probably a point where he had resentment from his perspective or he saw a missed opportunity. And so I have a lot of compassion for both of you in that scenario. But a lot of people do give up and become cynical and angry at this crossroads and do actually spend most of their energy tearing down, looking backwards. Again, kudos to you. I'm sure because of that chip on your shoulder from 16 gave you the energy to give it another swing in a new version.
You're right. And I was very disappointed on a personal level. But if I look back,
it's the best thing that ever happened to you.
Yes.
And of course.
The two things. The fact that he trusted me was unbelievable. I was
huge,
nobody.
Huge.
I was a kid. I was 28. I didn't know anything. This guy trusted me, gave me my chance. And like he took me under his wing.
And by
literally.
The way. Him leaving is the best thing that happened to you because that's why you're sitting here right now. 100,000%.
Exactly.
So what's your next big break? So now you got to build up your own brand.
Yeah.
What happens? Because I assume some kids came through in those 6 years. Something must have happened, right?
Yeah, I decided to speak to all my team. So I had everyone around. I said, guys, so I'm going to put my name because I don't want the same thing to happen again. But I'm not a tennis coach. Yeah. So now I have to become a tennis coach. I was like 33 years old. The guys told me, but you never give a tennis lesson in your life. What are you talking about? Like they were all professional coaches. And I said to them, well, guys, you're right, but I learned fast. So I'm going to start now. And I gave myself 10 years to win a Grand Slam as a coach, which is, I mean, 99.9% of the coaches will never win a Grand Slam as coaches in their life. And it took me 10 years to win. And I won 10 with Serena. So... yeah, so my plan worked, and it worked, and I always say that, for two reasons. First of all, you couldn't find someone more motivated than me, I think. It was impossible. I was literally thinking, coaching day and night, waking up at night with ideas, writing them down. And the thing that was an asset at that time is that I didn't know anything.
100 Blind eyes are dangerous. That's what I always say.
Yeah.
Blind eyes are dangerous. My entire career... every industry I've gone into, I knew nothing about. And I'm always dominant because all I do is try to figure out what's value, not how people did it.
I had exactly the same strategy. I thought, well, I don't have the tactical tools, the technical tools. I didn't learn anything. But I have to figure out how to make this player win.
Which led to why it worked, because the technical tools are a commodity. The mental tools are not. The seeing the gray is not. The commodity, anybody can teach you a proper forehand or a backhand over time, can be taught. You can watch fucking videos. The gray of being number one in the world is the actual punchline.
Yeah. And I was all about how to win. How does my player win points? How does she lose points? And how can I help her win more?
Who was your first significant player in that 10-year run who, let's say, had got to the quarters? Or who was your first significant player?
Marcos Baghdatis.
Oh, yes.
So he reached the final of the Australian Open. I started with him. He was 13 and a half years old. He was at my tennis academy. And when he got older and started to play on tour, he asked me to coach him.
So that was a big moment.
Oh, yeah. Huge. Huge. And
what was the, if I asked you privately, and now it's going to be publicly, what's the thing you're most proud of that you helped Marcos with? Whether it was, by the way, whether it's following the narrative we've been talking about and something about mind, or maybe if it's just actually something technical. If I asked you the thing that you're most proud of or you feel good about, it feels nice inside of you, something subtle or specific that you helped him with. Thoughts?
You know, you have to understand how people work. I mean, work. How they process.
Yes.
How they process.
Yes.
What makes them have the will, the motivation, you know, and put everything on the table.
Yes.
And Marcos was all about emotions, all about it, all about love.
Mm.
If he would feel love from you and for you, he would die on the court. And I think I made him feel that.
That's awesome. It's really cool. What happens next? What's the next significant player?
I mean, they were not super famous.
It's okay.
But they were good players, and they become better with me every time, and that's what I was very proud of.
And that's where you were getting confidence, right? This was happening, you're like,
thank
to your
you.
Point, right? Yes.
Yeah, no,
if,
thank you.
If you were one, if they were 113 in the world, they come to you and they're 89, that means something.
100%. And I always say we are all the result of all our experiences.
That's right.
When you create positive experiences, you build the feeling that you are good at what you're doing, you become better.
Affirmation, affirmation, affirmation.
Yes, and especially when you keep that mindset that I had from day one, which is my strength, which is I'm good because I always start thinking I know nothing, and
correct.
I kept that.
Humility is foundational.
Because some coaches have a result, very good results with one player, and they think, oh, now I know.
Correct.
And this is when they're done,
game
it's
over.
Finished. And then they repeat the same recipe
That's right.
all their life. That's
right.
not coaching.
That's right.
Coaching is a different recipe every
That's
time.
Right.
You have to discover how to make a great bolognese pasta, like if it's the first time you're going to do it.
If I asked you a coaching regret, or in hindsight, you could have done something a little bit better with a player because you didn't see it, but that player taught you and you didn't make the same mistake in the future. Does anything stand out?
Like, I'm not about regrets. I never have regrets.
Yes,
I don't
get
regret
that.
Anything that I did
yes.
in my life, and I did mistakes like everybody.
Yeah.
The only thing I can regret, because of one reason, because it destroyed my relationship with him,
mm-hmm.
is what happened with Marcos at the end, because I was not listening to him anymore mm. and understanding him anymore, and he was doing so well, I wanted him to keep going,
mm.
and I was not able to listen anymore, and I was more like acting like a bad father.
Mm.
Like I own him; he's like my son.
Mm.
So he can't go a different direction from the one I want.
Mm.
And this is it was not coaching anymore, and I was not in a coaching relationship with him anymore.
It became deeper emotional.
Exactly, and I reacted.
Which is why you're empathetic to your father about what he did with you.
Totally, and I reacted too much emotionally mm. rather than as a coach, and. He didn't understand me at that time, and our relationship became bad, and this was really bad. And if I look at that, I was a terrible coach at the end of the relationship with Marcos, and this was the biggest lesson for me. I mm. never did that again, never ever. I always find a way to take mm-hmm. emotion away, and when I felt, every time I felt emotional in my job as a coach, I was always
feel, mm-hmm.
shutting up,
mm-hmm.
taking
Walker.
Time away,
yep.
and coming back only when I was ready
thank,
because the emotion
thank you,
was out.
Thank you for sharing that. That's going to help a lot of people. Thank you. So I have an interesting question just for fun. This is just my tennis nerdom. This, by the way, I'm sorry to everybody. I'm just going completely, I've been doing pretty well in a linear line, but I'm just going completely random now because I'm too excited to ask this. I've been waiting the whole time to ask this question, actually. Observing from afar and being very in the sport, which player, as you've been very deep over the last 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it's been, do you believe was most side railed by injuries, and had she or he not been hurt, they would have been a number one player or an iconic player? Just complete tennis fun chat. I'll give you a second because it's a fun question.
Okay, it's, so someone who's been so injured, he would have been number one
over the last 15, so. Yeah, over the last 10, 15 years, 20 years, you've been so deep in this. Whether it was early on, like, you have such a great eye, that you're a professional, you know what the fuck you're talking about, not me like a fan. Just, if I said to you that question, somebody who's come along in the last 20 years that you're disappointed because you would have loved to see them play her or him at their highest level, but unfortunately, it was injuries that kind of derailed them. Less so mindset, because I think a lot of those people come along too, but injuries. I'm just genuinely curious.
Yeah. No, there is one I think of, unfortunately, I don't remember his name, and he's American, and he was unbelievable. He's the same generation as Marty Fish. Of course, I don't remember his name because he didn't do so well. But,
so he came up with Fish, Blake, those guys,
yes,
right?
Yes, and he was...
Well, somebody who's listening right now, give your guests on Twitter. Yeah. Describe him a little bit, because that will probably help some of the hardcore fans remember.
Incredibly talented, playing very flat, very loose, great. I mean, he had everything, this guy. And he had, like, injuries all his career. And he never made it to very high. I think he was top 100. He was top 100, I think, maybe once, but not for long. And he would have been top 10 for sure.
In your subjective opinion, Eisner, you know, like all these guys, he was on a different planet.
I mean, we're talking about guys who were top 10.
Yeah, fair enough.
So he was, for me, at least able to be top 10, if not more.
Wow.
And I know a lot of people think the same, by the way.
You just can't recall his name right now.
Yes, and there is another one I'm thinking of, but she's still playing. It's Andreescu. I think Andreescu has a huge game. Mentally, she's so strong, but so young and still, already struggling with a lot of injuries. And I think that... For her, the question about having a great career or not is only about managing her body to stay away from injuries. It's going to be the fight of all her career.
Who was your favorite player growing up?
So, strangely, because I was playing serve and volley and return volley, I was always at the net. My favorite player was Bjorn Borg.
Of course.
And then Pat Rafter, later.
Patrick.
Oh, for me. The player I've loved the most watching.
I loved Stefan Edberg. Like, loved.
Really?
Yes. I don't even know why. It was
what did you love about him?
He seemed small. He seemed kind of like... You know what I loved about him? It was just timing. I grew up... You know, I loved McEnroe as a kid. East Coast, I'm a hothead. I did all the stupid things on the court, like McEnroe at 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, when I played a lot. But... Then Lendl came along and kind of took that from McEnroe, and I hated Lendl, right? I was, you know, my parents left the Soviet bloc, so fuck you, Lendl. And he was very mean looking, and I was scared of Lendl. And Edberg kind of like, you know, I liked Mats Wilander a little bit, you know, but like Edberg kind of had that little period in that Edberg owned that little window for 2 or 3 years in between the Lendl era and then when the whole, you know, Sampras and Agassi thing started. I liked his net game, you know, because I also played that well. I was small and I wasn't strong, so I was incredibly intuitive, so I played at the net a ton. It's also why I already brought up Michael Chang, right? Smaller, you know, it fit me, and it was the height of when I was watching.
Yeah, I liked also Stefan Edberg, a great guy also. I think it was too clean for me. I love the Rafter style. Like, it was so physical at the net, jumping, very animal. That's what I loved with him. He was an animal at the net.
You know, it's funny. The reason I love Novak the most, and right from the beginning, there's a moment that Novak does often, and I'm always wondering if people understand what he's doing, because it is how I live my life. My chip is less... around my parents, and it's more against the world. I love being an underdog. Even right now as I'm telling you this story, my competitive chemicals are moving. I can feel it. I believe that Novak had it better than anybody ever, because the world loves Rafa and Federer. And so my favorite moment in tennis ever is a recent phenomenon, which is when Novak plays
Wimbledon
I love you so much, and the whole fucking world is against him. That their classic match 4 years ago, or whatever, 3 years ago, I was at a bar eating with the kids, and the whole place is rooting for Raj. And there was a big point in that fifth set, like a stunning point that Novak won, and I got so pumped, loud, yeah! And and everybody looked at me, and a guy came over to me and said, "You're not really rooting for him." I go, "With all my fucking heart." But what Novak does, and I fucking love this so fucking much, there's no business version of it, so I can never really do it. Only when I buy the Jets and win a Lombardi trophy will I be able to feel this, where he wins the match or a point, and he just looks at the entire crowd and just says, "Fuck you. Now what?" I love it. That look he does, it's everything to me. And so it's funny that you say too clean, because it's funny. I, by far, my favorite players have been more dirty, but the height of me watching all the tournaments, you know, on ESPN watching Cincinnati, like the height of my like consumption, because then I started working at 14 and had no time to watch TV, was Edberg. But what Novak represents right now speaks to me the most, because nobody's rooting for him. Nobody.
And there is another reason why he is who he is. You are totally right in what you're saying, for sure. He uses the fact that he's an underdog, and he's using the fact that people are against me for in his favor to become better, to find more
100%.
Grit.
100%.
But the second thing that he has is the belief. Because if you go back in time, maybe 15 years ago, Rafa and Roger were winning absolutely everything.
Correct.
And I knew all the top 10s at that time already, and I was speaking to them, and all of them were telling me it's impossible to win a Grand Slam because those two guys, they're
in a different planet.
Different planet. And I remember a young guy, 19, coming up and playing finally Roger in a Grand Slam, first rounds, and he was nobody yet. And he's interviewed the day before, and in the press he says, "I'm going to beat him." And I remember the press saying, "Who the fuck is this guy? Who does he think he is? He's so cocky." And I remember him saying, "I'm not cocky. I believe in myself." And this guy, who was, as you understood, Novak, ended up beating the two greatest of all times, became number one, and will probably end up being the greatest of all times, because he believed in himself more than anyone, even at a time when it was almost impossible to believe in oneself beating the two guys. So that's the power of belief. And of course, it comes also from your education, from the fact that, I'm coming back to that, people believe in you so much, but it's also something that you build throughout your experiences, and you reach a point where the belief is so strong that nothing can destroy it, and it's the biggest gas you can put in your car.
What happens to a player that's number one for a while when she or he, what is typical in your opinion of when they lose the belief? So what's amazing about my life, because I think through sports 24/7, but in business, it's not a winner take all game. You know, it's not like I'm playing, like I'm winning, and many people that I look at that I know are like me, they're winning and I'm happy for them. Because the world of business, everyone can win, really. Even if you're competing against somebody in business, there's so much market. In tennis, there's a tournament, so only one person wins. I will never lose the belief we're talking about, ever, ever, ever. I'm blindly religious that I'm gonna be the greatest businessman of all time. And then there's really no affirmation one way or the other along the way that I go. But I wonder with a John McEnroe, because he has to be believing, or a Connors, or a Becker, or an Agassi, or a Sampras, or a, like, what have you seen, or what tends to happen, or can you notice when you can see the switch of, for 3.5 years they believe that, and something's happening, whether it's an outside force or an inside force, that clicks it the other way?
Very, very interesting question. First of all, most of the very, very, very good young players go climb the rankings very fast. So they're in a success
cocoon,
exactly. And at some point, when you reach the really, really top, sometimes you hit the wall. One time, two times, three times. You know, you play a Grand Slam semi, you lose to Novak, and then you lose to Rafa, and then you lose to Roger. And after a certain time, you stop to believe. And I can see it from outside, because I see that suddenly there are some things, if you really pay attention, you can see it.
That's why
and
I'm
you
asking.
See, for example, they would take a coach that is not too expensive. Suddenly, oh, interesting. Because you don't invest anymore in your career? Okay. You send me a very good message. Mm. It's quite clear. But then even going to the, talking about the best, you know, talking about Serena, for example, who is probably the great, I mean, she is the greatest of all times. No, not probably.
Both sides.
She has 23 Grand Slams, and I started working with her. She has 13, which is already incredible.
Insane.
When I start working with him, she's at a period of time when she's doubting because 2 years without winning a Grand Slam, it's long for someone like her.
Yes.
It's long. And she's number 7 in the world. And, you know,
yeah.
she's doubting. You know, anyone can doubt.
Of course.
Even the greatest. And when I start with her, I have a very clear image of her because I look very closely, even from afar, because I was not coaching her before. And I have a clear idea of how she processes and how she thinks. And when I start working together, the first tournament she plays is Wimbledon. And she reaches the semifinals. And when she's in the semis, I will remember that all my life. I'm at the restaurant in Wimbledon and she runs to me with a big smile and she says, guess what? Whatever happens at the end of the tournament, I'm going to be top 3 in the world. And I can't believe she's saying something like that.
Interesting.
I can't believe it. So I answer, and what? She says, it's great, no? I said, what are you talking about? Being 3 in the world is great?
You're fucking 13
for
times,
you?
Yeah.
Are you joking? I can't believe it. So she doesn't answer. And in the evening, she sends me a text message and she said, sorry for what I said today. That was ridiculous. Number 3 is terrible. And number 2 also.
Even worse.
And the lesson I learned at that moment is even the greatest of all times who processed, I mean, you have no idea how they think because for her, number 2 is the worst thing on the planet. Even them, when doubt comes,
pockets.
You can start to think
100%.
Wrong.
Life is long. You go through journeys, ups and downs. I love that. And what happened in that Wimbledon?
She won it. And then
she did.
Singles and doubles. 3 weeks after, she won Olympic gold medals in singles and doubles. 1 month after, she won the US Open. And at the end of the year, she won the Masters. And then 2 months after, she was number one.
It.
And she stayed 3.5 years in a row, number one in the world.
Love it. What have we not touched on as we wrap up here? Anything that you want people to think about?
I mean, we can talk UTS, but it's going to be too long, I think. So.
Yeah, I want you to ask him about where he thinks tennis is going.
Since we don't edit, that was Maha in the background. Maha, always fun to have you. Always fun to have you on the podcast. Yeah, where do you think tennis is going?
Well, if I look at the demographics, they don't look good. A lot of studies have been made on tennis and on golf and on other sports by the TV channels. And they found out that the average age of the fan of tennis who is following tennis and watching tennis on a regular basis is 61 years old, which is very old, 64 for golf, but it's very old. And it's getting older every year. And I'm upset with that. And I'm all worrying also, you know, for our sport. And I start to try to understand why. And if I look at the situation, what I understand is that the tennis format is a very old format. It's more than a century ago.
Yes.
It was created. And the way people consume that type of content has completely changed in the last 10, 15 years with
Correct.
The digital. So what people are watching today, it's contents which are short, dynamic,
Fast.
Immersive, and authentic.
MMA,
for
esports.
Example.
Yep.
Exactly. So tennis is long, sometimes
yep.
very long. Yesterday, 5 hours.
Yes.
Match. Slow.
Yes.
The time when the ball is in play is less than 15% of the time.
That's right.
Non-immersive at all and not authentic because they all pretend they're the nicest people on the planet. And, you know, which is
now,
clearly not
now,
the case.
Now you're really going into why I love Novak versus the field.
Exactly.
Oh, Rodolitz, Harwood, you listening to that little subtle moment? Keep going, my friend.
So I thought, oh, we have to do something because the ATP, the WTA, the Grand Slams are not going to change tennis. And I don't think we should change tennis. Tennis is beautiful the way it is.
Yes.
We have a billion fans.
Yes.
Yes, they're getting older because our fan base is the fan base that fell in love with tennis in the 70s and the 80s.
Yes.
And we're not renewing our fan base and we're not reaching out to the young generation.
And if you think about it, it even gets scarier because if you think about Raj, Rafa, Novak, Serena, you're talking about global icons. They're not unknown. they're pretty fucking famous in the scheme of things to a 20 and 30 and 40 year old. So you've got a golden era of celebrity, and yet you still have this problem. It's not like, you know, as you know, there's been pockets sometimes when we have stars transitioning where some people sneak in a couple of cheap grand slams that aren't all time. This is not one of them. And so for that to be the case, it becomes double concerning.
It is. And so we're not renewing our fan base, and we're not reaching out to the young generation. So as tennis has to stay the way it is, I decided to create a second league, which would be, in a way, complementary to the main league, to the league that we all know, ATP, WTA, Grand Slams, a second league with the goal to reach out to the new generations. So
in parallel, pockets, yeah, that don't disrupt the core schedule. Smart.
Exactly.
Like
exactly.
The, you know, my favorite football league, I'm an American football fan to the nine. There was a league in the 80s called the USFL, and I loved it. Why? Because it played in the spring. It didn't disrupt the NFL. Unfortunately, the ownership there decided they had to go against the NFL. They sued the NFL. And it failed, but it's too bad because the league had momentum. They had real players, Reggie White, Steve Young, iconic players, Jim Kelly. And it could have been a great league, and then I would have gotten more football. And I've always thought that the biggest mistake of when somebody tries to disrupt the establishment is they don't play the pockets of reverse engineering the white space. And it's funny to hear you say this. I didn't know this. You're basically doing a league version of what you do for an athlete. You're playing around the reality instead of trying to create the conflict.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think there is a space for everyone. And I think it's great for tennis.
And when did you start this?
I started last year, right after the confinement in France.
Oh, right. And then COVID, and it's a little challenging.
Exactly. And I said, I'm going to do it. And I want to do the proof of concept.
Yeah.
So I told the team, listen, guys, imagine we create tennis today, knowing what we know about how people consume that kind of content.
That's
how
right.
would you do it? So we create something, a match is 45 minutes, much less time between the points, coaching at every point.
Coaching at every point.
Every point. They have cards. They can use cards to have extra, like, I want one extra serve.
At 45 minutes, oh, interesting. At 45 minutes, it's over and whoever's winning wins?
Yes, but it's four quarters of 8 minutes. Every quarter is 8 minutes. There is, at every changeover, there is an interview. It can be a celebrity.
I like it very much.
Entertaining.
Is it,
super
can I watch some of it? Is it online? Where could I can see some
you
of
can
it?
Watch online.
What's it
link.
Called?
UTS, which means Ultimate Tennis Showdown.
I love it.
And so we did it. I had most of the top players who played, like Zverev, Tsitsipas, Berrettini, Medvedev. Most of them.
Real players.
We were broadcasted since day one in more than 100 countries in the world. We
streaming?
Streaming.
Very nice.
Also on our TT platform. We have more than 1.3 million fans already on Facebook after just four events. We have more than 120,000 people who are subscribers on our OTT platform. So, I mean, for me, the proof of concept is made. So now we're into a capital raise to go full.
Good for you.
And to do a real season only with 10 events, because I don't want to disrupt the ATP and the WTA.
Right.
10 events, 10 big events. And this is my thing. 10 players only, 10 events, 10 cities. Why 10 players? Because I found out that 90% of the people...
Does that mean somebody has a bye?
No, I play with only 10 players. Formula One is 20 drivers.
Got it.
It's only 10. Why? Because I found out that 90% of the fans do not know 90% of the players.
You're being very nice. You know that, right? 98% of the fans don't. I mean, really? Because I'm really... Because I've thought, as an entrepreneur, 3-4 years ago, the reason I can answer that is because I was like, maybe I'm going to disrupt tennis. Like, it's so real. I think the opportunity is very real. I love that. Listen, we've got to go, Patrick. Thank you so much. Everybody, please, do you have social handles where people can follow you?
Of course.
Spell it out.
My Instagram?
Yes.
At P Muratoglu.
You want to spell that? Because there's a lot of people going to be, what the fuck is that?
P-M-O-U-R-A-T-O-G-L-O-U.
I love it. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
As we end today's podcast, I want to give a huge shout out to the people. You know, it's so funny. People that leave reviews and written reviews of this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms just mean the world to me. You've taken an extra 13 to 95 seconds to show love and also give context to people of why this is a worthwhile podcast. So I appreciate that so much. And even more fun, because I think we all love a little cosign or a shout out or a little awareness, I'm going to have the team give a couple of shout outs daily on our favorite reviews. So take it away. Which were our favorites this week?
Thanks so much, Gary. Today's amazing review reads, "Come on, how can you not love the Gary V audio experience? I'm a follower and a student of Gary V. All platforms and all opportunities to listen to his stream of influence. His podcast rocks and brings together all his thoughts and observations together in one capsule. It's daily for me and push my interest in audio. Thank you, Gary V." Thank you so much for that kind review. And to anybody else listening out there, if you leave us a review, you might just get shouted out in the next episode.